I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mark Reed joins me again. He is the editor-in-chief of the magazine Canada's History, formerly The Beaver. He's the editor of a new book, another great book of Canadian history, 100 Days That Changed Canada. Selected therein are 100 dates that, by virtue of the events of the day, the people involved and more, truly shaped this country. There are obvious dates like the 1st of July, 1867, but there are dates in here like the 2nd of September, 1972, which is the first game of the summit series between Team Canada and the Soviets, and not the 28th of September, the final game. That essay by Ken Dryden makes a case for the 2nd of September. That's what Mr. Reed has done, gathered noted contributors to write about each date. Some of the contributors include Peter Mansbridge, Adrian Clarkson, Bob Ray, J.L. Granatstein, Peter C. Newman, Rona Maynard, Conrad Black, and Margaret Wente. We'll talk about how this book came about and about the dates that truly changed this country. Mark Reed was last on for the book 100 Photos That Changed Canada. This book now is a fine companion to that book and is the beginning of a great conversation on history, our country, what's in this book and why, as well as what's not in the book. 100 Days That Changed Canada is published by HarperCollins. CanadasHistory.ca is the website for more. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Mark Reed. Good morning, Mr. Reed.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So the success of the last book, did that surprise you? I mean, it did well, right?
Yeah, it did really well. And you're right, it did surprise us a bit. You know, taking a step back, as a publisher of a history magazine, you know, we were well aware that there was an appetite for history. And, you know, with The Beaver and now Canada's History Magazine, we've been around for 90-odd years. So we know there's a core of Canadians out there who care about the past and enough to put down their hard-earned money and buy the magazine. But what we didn't know was whether or not there was a wider audience for stories from Canada's past, and especially a book costs more than a magazine. It's more of a commitment to get a book, and so we weren't quite sure whether or not anybody would share the same, same enthusiasm that we had. And so when we did the book, we were hoping to sell a handful, and it turned out to be the best-selling book of 2009 in the history category in Canada, and one of the top 10 bestsellers in nonfiction in the nation. So, of course, it was quite a surprise, a pleasant surprise.
And the debate that it started, I mean, we had a great discussion when we talked about it a couple years ago, but you had that throughout the country when you went on the book tour, and I'm sure you're having the same about this book now, right?
Yeah, you know, I think, well, it's probably similar for lots of countries, but, you know, I think with Canada especially, you know, so many different regions, so many different thoughts on you know, what is the story of Canada, and that really changes depending on who you are, where you're from. If you're a Nova Scotian or a British Columbian or a Quebecer or an Ontarian, and whether you live in a rural area, whether you live in the city, that's going to really affect you and how the importance you put on certain dates. And so for every image in the first book or date in the second book where people go, yes, that's right, 100%, I agree, there's probably three or four that they would say, oh, what are you doing? Are you kidding me? Why? How can you have a book without this date, without this photo? And, you know, that was part of our goal in doing both books, was to get that debate going, to get that conversation going.
We'll talk about some dates that are obvious, that are obvious dates that should be in this book and ones that aren't in just a sec. But I'm interested, how did you get to the concept of actual days, actual dates?
Well, the first book was focused on the photo.
Yeah.
It really was on the photo. And the one thing first of all, you know, the first question might be, how did you know there was enough material for a second book? And, you know, when we were doing the short list for the first book, at one point I had more than 300 photos floating around that could have possibly made the final cut. You know, we had a long list and then a short list and then tried to winnow it down. And so one of the things that became really clear in the first book was that there was way too much information, way too many great photos and moments to fit into that first book. And so that gave us a lot of great great material for a second book. But then you're right, what's the next logical step? And the one thing I found a bit limiting in the first book is that when you tie a moment to a day, or sorry, when you tie a moment to a photo, the photo takes precedence. the photo has to exist and it has to come first and it has to be iconic before we would put it in the book. And there are, for instance, photos of events that aren't quite iconic but are very, very important. And then the other thing you realize is that there were lots of important turning points where there was no photographer. And so does that mean that we as a history society ignore those moments and never introduce those to a wider audience? I'll give you a good example. One of my favorite moments in the 100 Days of Change Canada is the moment where Nellie McClung and other women in Winnipeg go to the Walker Theatre, now the Burton Cummings Theatre here in Winnipeg, and they have a mock parliament where they use the power of humor. They use humor as a weapon to make points about how just absolutely ridiculous it is that women are not allowed to vote. They do that through satire. And you know, you wish that there had been a video camera watching this to just see the wit and the humor that would have been on stage that night. There was no photos there. There was no cameraman there. And so that moment does not exist in a visual sense for us. I wanted it. I wanted people to know about that date in 1914. And so with the new book, what we were able to do is to, I don't want to say free us, but in a way it was. It was a bit liberating to be able to introduce moments that we feel are important, but not be limited by whether or not a photo is in existence that illustrates that moment.
Sort of like the pablum being invented. I mean, you can't really have a photo of that, can you?
Well, some, I think, too, you know, photos, my wife is a photographer, and of course, I'm a photo junkie. I love photos. Yeah. I love great photography. But it can also really limit your understanding, I think, in a lot of ways, because sometimes the photo, for instance, let's say cameras did exist throughout all the days that were in existence in the book, in the new book. Well, sometimes the photo of the actual event is not as poignant, telling, illustrative as a photo of a moment that was affected by the date. And so you hit it on the head with pablum. You know, maybe a person, if it did exist, could have a photo of a fellow in a lab coat in a black and white photo, and he's stirring some mush together in a test tube, hoping to come up with a formula for pablum. Or you can use the photo we used, which was a little boy loving pablum so much he's licking the plate, you know, which tells a different story about the impact of that moment. And so that's really what this new book is about. It's about moments that mattered and their impact, the ripple effect, how they affect the future. You know, I think in some ways you actually see how the future was affected throughout the timeline, because staying on the theme of women and women's achievements and women's rights, you see the day in 1914 when Nellie McClung stands up for women. You see in World War II where the women go and sign up with the military and they make a breakthrough and are able to serve. You see in the 70s when the Status of Women report comes out and the woman with the miniskirt and the bullhorn is demanding equal rights. And you see that progression through time. And that's, I think, another important thing to show people is that the cause and effect of various events.
So the history doesn't get changed that day necessarily, right?
I do, you know, honestly, I think we all can look around and realize that it is very rare in any nation's history where history changes on a dime. It does happen. Think about the Americans, the assassination of Lincoln or JFK. That's a really good example. I would argue that a great example in our book is the Mulroney-Turner debate.
Right.
You know, when Mulroney strikes that you had an option, sir, and ends up going on and winning the election. I think so. History can change automatically, but I think history in general changes a lot more incrementally. And then sometimes an event can actually occur, and we won't even realize that that was the key moment until years and decades later. It's only through that hindsight that you actually look back and realize, wow, that was a moment. That was a moment that mattered. A good example is the Winnipeg flood. You know, I'm a bit parochial here because I'm interviewing with you in Winnipeg, but I'll tell you, this would be a very different city if that Winnipeg flood didn't happen, and if Duff Roblin, therefore, wasn't given the incentive to build the dike, the floodway around Winnipeg, and we allowed multiple just earth-shattering, destructive floods to wipe out Winnipeg. rather than create this thing that showed a lot of bravery and end up saving billions of dollars over the past few decades by protecting the city. You know, who knew that that 1950 flood at that moment would have affected the future of not only the province, the city, but the province so far.
So when you had when you're putting this new book together, I'm sure you had more than 100 dates. How do you whittle that down? How do you take it down to 100?
Well, you know, it's funny, and this is a bit of a joke I like to tell, but it's deadly serious. At one point, I was sitting here. I was working nights and weekends in addition to my day job trying to get this finished, and I'm sure it was around probably anywhere from 11 till 2 in the morning, and I was just staring at my computer at this sort of short list of dates, yeah, trying to whittle it down, and I seriously thought, man, I'm going to have to call HarperCollins and tell them we're going to change the name to the 117 Days of Change Canada, because I cannot figure it out. But, you know, bringing it back to more serious discussion, the thing we also wanted to do with this book, and this does get to your question, is that we wanted to make sure that we, as much as possible, showed our readers that history is more than just guys in uniforms with guns running out of a trench trying to take over a hill or capture a key landmark. Now, that's very important. Doesn't matter what generation you're from, military history, that political history, that traditional uppercase H history is important. But I think there's a wider acceptance now that there's an importance of showing cultural moments, social moments, something is seemingly frivolous as Mr. Dressup taking to the airwaves for the first time. That would not have made a history book, The 100 Days That Changed Canada, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, ignore the fact that he wouldn't have been on. But that kind of moment would never have made it into a book, because history had a notion that it had to be totally serious, totally focused on dates and what they used to call the great man motif of history. It's the story of the towering colossi that stride the land, and the rest of us little people just look up. Well, we want to tell more stories, and so we get a book like this, and we're able to do those cultural moments, like stomping Tom Connors, giving back his Junos. We're able to get those moments where Halifax City Council bulldozes Africville. You know, would that have made a history book 20 years ago?
Yeah.
That type of history. And so that's really what, you know, in terms of picking those moments, there are probably some iconic moments, and I hesitate using that word, but there's probably some iconic moments that are not in this book. And people will open it up and say, well, what's the History Society doing? What are they, you know, how could you not have this moment? Well, it's a conscious decision to make room for some of these other moments that are also important, but maybe aren't as tectonic in the way that they have shaped the country. You know, the way they shape the country is a bit more subtle than just, you know, the Battle of the Plains of Abraham or those huge Vimy Ridge, those huge moments that everybody learns about in school.
I mentioned off the top the Dryden piece on the Summit series. And, you know, everyone remembers the 28th of September, the final game when Canada wins. I mean, there's film of people across the country just watching the game. I can remember the clip of Diefenbaker sitting on the sofa there with Olive watching the game. But the date that's in this book is not the 28th, it's the 2nd, which was, I guess, the first game, right?
Yeah.
And why that instead of the date that everyone seems to remember?
Well, that's actually a really good example to bring up to touch on a couple different things. You know, when I was putting this book together, and I consulted with, as I always do, with historians and archivists and others, and was trying to come up with this list, and, you know, there was several months of research before we even started trying to whittle down the dates. One of the things that people may, if they haven't read either our 100 photos book or this book, one thing that they may not remember or realize is that this isn't just a book where I just sat down and wrote essays for 100 different things. This is a book of prominent Canadians writing their thoughts on moments that we all kind of all agreed were important. And so we're able to get someone like Ken Dryden, who was part of the Summit series, writing about that moment. And one of the things I loved about the process, and we have almost double the number of contributors this time, 34 versus 56 this time. One of the things I loved about the process is that sometimes the contributors can teach me a lesson. Because I can have like all of us, we have our preconceived notions of various things. And I went into, I knew the summit series had to be there. It was a crucial moment.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought, oh, well, you know, I'm 40, so I was 1 year old when the summit series happened. So I have no memories of that. But I, like everyone, have been brought up on the legend of Paul Henderson scoring that goal and that iconic photo of him with his arms raised. But I was thinking, you know, was that the day that changed hockey? I'm not sure. And so I remembered in Game 4, it was, that Phil Esposito, they got booed off, the Canadian team got booed off the ice, and Esposito took it so hard that he gave that interview at the end of the game where he was almost crying on national television and telling everybody that they were doing their best and they got the, you know, Canadians needed to get off their back and rally around them. And so when I called Ken Dryden up, I said, Ken, I got a great idea. You know, I don't think Henderson's goal was the moment. I think, you know, it has to be Esposito rallying the country. And he was quiet for a little bit. And then he came back and actually said, you know what, I respect your opinion, but you're wrong. The moment when everything changed was the first game. Because going into that first game, we were cocky. We were a nation that was totally sure of ourselves in terms of our supremacy in hockey. And we kind of had that cock of the walk swagger that we're the best, we know we're the best, and now we're going to show the world and prove it once and for all that we are the greatest. And you have to remember, the Russians had only started playing hockey a few years prior to this, you know, maybe 15 years or so. I think it was 1954 that they did their first ever world tournament. And so it really became a clash of nations here, and clash of communism versus capitalism. Our pros were finally going to take on the Russians and give them a beatdown. And we walked in there, and we were up 2-0. And everybody was, you know, clapping and laughing and having drinks in the crowd and saying, there you go, it's going to be a cakewalk. And then we got destroyed 7-3. And so Ken's argument is that you don't win when you have six. You don't learn from your successes. You learn from your failures. And that was the world's biggest wake-up call to a hockey-mad nation, that it had to change its game. And so even though we won the series, we won it by the skin of our teeth. And yes, everybody across the country slapped each other on the back and said, oh, look at that, we won. But Ken said everybody who was in the hockey world went back and looked at each other in the mirror and said, you know what, oh my Lord, we need to go back to the drawing board. We don't want to admit it, but skill matters, finesse matters. We cannot just go around skating each other and ramming them in the boards and elbowing each other and not training in the off season. You know, Canadian training back then was to go out to their cabin and go fishing. Hang out with the boys all summer, and then, you know, come September, you'd put your skates on. Meanwhile, the Russians were doing dry land training the entire off-season and skating year-round. And so that's, you know, a great example of how sometimes we remember moments, but maybe they were not the ones that really were the turning point. They were the moments of the loudest applause.
Well, on the cover of the book, you have Terry Fox. It might seem like a silly question. Was there a lot of debate on who would be on the cover? I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer, but I'm wondering, was he the first choice, the only choice?
You know, the cover is the one thing that is the most collaborative between myself and HarperCollins. The book was designed by the team at HarperCollins, and I had a conversation with one of the editors there about, you know, the moments in the book, what can we do? You know, if you recall the cover of the first book, it was a bit easier to design, to be honest with you, because it had that photo motif.
Yeah.
So you could get that reel of it's so weird to say that word, in this digital age. People are going to be wondering, what's a photo reel? I don't understand. But you have that reel of film,
yeah,
that went across the cover, and you could see a whole bunch of different images. Well, we didn't just want to replicate that, and you know, we started thinking to ourselves, Terry Fox is one of the few people, I think, that cuts across generations in terms of an iconic, beloved character. Also cuts across gender. What he stands for, the fight against cancer, impacts all of us. Every one of us, you, me, everybody knows someone who's gone through cancer, had cancer, lost someone to cancer. And so, you know, plus he represents such a positive image that we just, at the end of the day, you know, we kind of toyed with different themes, different images, and just thought, you know, at the end of the day, this book isn't about rah-rah, everything from Canadian history has been perfect, but we wanted to send the message that there are moments that we all can collectively be proud of as well, and we wanted to have that positive image on the cover as opposed to something else.
Now, there are two events from the last year, from 2010. The Canada for Haiti telethon, the Olympics, of course, the G20 riots in Toronto, and then in November of last year, the government deciding to extend the mission in Afghanistan. Those are four events. How did you come to I mean, it seems to me that when you have four events from one year, it seems to be a significant year. Do we know that? Did we know that at the end of the year, say a year ago, or is this something that you think will have ramifications down the line, and you're just forward thinking as a historian?
Well, I hate to say it, but you know, it's the eternal challenge with trying to do a book that spans the breadth of time and goes up to modern times. You know, there was a saying when I first started my job here at the History Society. I went to a conference one time, and they were saying that unless an event is more than 40 years old, it cannot be termed history.
Yeah.
I don't buy that. I don't buy that at all. I'm a journalist by trade. I'm a historian. I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter. And so all I look for are the stories. And I think when it comes to history, the biggest enemy history has is the word history itself. Because people hear the word history and they think of the god-awful, boring classes that they were forced to sit through when they were in grade 7 or 8, where a teacher just lectured at them and said, read chapter 7, there's a test on Tuesday. I look at history is really memory. It's whether it's our memories. I'm 40. My memories go back a little shy of 40 years. But my parents go back 60-odd years. And their parents go back 90 to 100 years. And so, you know, when you think about where we started, 1867, that is really the memory of my ancestors only a handful of generations removed, right? And so the less we consign the memories of our ancestors to the dustbin of history by just labeling it history. If you want to insult someone, if you want to say that they have no importance whatsoever, what do you say? Oh, don't worry about them, they're history.
Yeah.
And so this book is an attempt by the History Society to make Canadians actually wake up and care about the memories that they have been entrusted to from their parents. These are the stories that you pass down. They used to be passed down around campfires and through song and tradition, and then we started writing them down. And somewhere we lost the ability. We drained the history of the emotion that makes it resonate with us as modern, forward-thinking humans in the 21st century. And so we need to go back, and we need to look at Sir John A. Macdonald through a different lens, not as a caricature of some fellow who half the time seemed like a buffoon with a drink in his hand, but instead as this man who had this single-minded dream of creating a country, but at the same time was dealing with his first wife died of opium addiction. He had a daughter who was born with hydrocephalus and was never able to care for herself. And so he was a human being who dealt with real issues at home while trying to put on a brave face at work and probably was trying to take the edge off by drinking. You know, that's something we can understand today.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about people from the past, in that type of flesh and blood conversation, I think then the history starts to come alive for us, and we can really feel empathy for these characters and hopefully learn from some of them. You know, when you think about, I have a friend who lost his wife to cancer 2 years ago and left behind now a 9-year-old boy. And you think about that terrible loss, or even, you know, Christopher Hitchens just passed away from cancer. Well, Terry Fox was no different than either of those two people, except looking around, he looked in the mirror and said, you know what, I'm going to get up, I'm going to try to do something. It's crazy, but I'm going to try to do it, and I'm going to try to change the world. And if, you know, if we can draw lessons like we can all change the world in our own little way, if we can believe in ourselves, that might be one lesson you draw from Terry Fox. Maybe if you look at Sir John A. Macdonald, you see that persistence and, you know, the refusal to give up on your dream might be an example of a lesson we can draw from his dream, which was to create Canada. And so, you know, even something like Africville. Lawrence Hill writes that essay about Africville. Well, what do we learn from Africville? Well, we learn one thing, which is that we have a really poor record of treating multicultural, different cultures in Canada. We treated them quite terribly in the past. So we can, that moment can change the way we treat people in the future, or at least hopefully change perceptions. So if we accomplish any of those things with this book, you know, then I think we've done our duty as a history society, and then the rest is up to Canadians. If they don't like what's in the book, if they think that these days are crazy and that there should have been other days, that's a fascinating and fantastic debate.
And another book, perhaps.
And another book.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, finally, Mark, on the state of Canadian history and in our media, online, and schools, are you generally hopeful?
You know, I think there is more reason for optimism now than there ever has been. Now, one of the things that we do at the History Society that probably doesn't get as much publicity as the magazine or the book is we also run something called the Governor General's Awards for History. And one of the things we do is we give out history awards to history teachers across the country who are going above and beyond the call of duty to really make an impact on their students. And I'll tell you, when I was a kid, my history lessons were taught in that exact same fashion I described. It was open the book to chapter 2, read it, there will be a test. You will fail or you will pass. And all of the wonder of the past was stripped from my lessons. And I think from certain generations that's the way it was taught. Today, holy cow, with all the multimedia stuff and the virtual worlds and the video games, we just finished the Governor General Awards in about a week ago. We just got back, and I got to meet 6 teachers from across the country who are getting their kids involved in making super fun comic books about their cultures and about where they came from. There was another group where everybody had to go and find an artifact, an old thing from like maybe their great-grandparents or their grandparents' house, come back, and then write projects not only about what the thing was, how it was made, what it was used for, what does it tell you about the society in which it was used, everything from old radios to farming implements from, the 1800s. There's a story I remember I was driving in the car on Remembrance Day, and they were talking to a teacher in northern Alberta who every Remembrance Day takes their kids out to the Bald Prairie, gives them shovels, and they have to dig a trench. The local seamstresses in town sew them uniforms so that they can all dress up like soldiers. Then they spend the night, they bring out fireworks and loud explosions, and that's playing in the dark while they talk about tales about World War I and why it mattered and the impact. And then the next day all the kids get together and the whole town, this little tiny town, comes out, and all the adults come in, and there here comes their kids, and they cheer them home as if they're you know, the boys returning from war. And then they all get together and discuss about what they learned and how that impacted, and they talk to veterans in the community. Wow. I mean, if that was happening when I was a young person, can you or anyone else, can you imagine how turned on you would be to learning more about history? And so, you know, a long-winded answer, but yes, I think our kids are in the right hands now, and what we need to do is to continue to showcase these types of teachers who are doing this type of history that really makes an impact on kids today, and hopefully give it another generation or two, and then we won't even be having this discussion anymore. You know, history will finally take its place back on the forefront as an important, an important heirloom that we all want to pass on, rather than something that's kind of dry and dusty that we just want to put on the shelf.
Mark, it's been nice talking again. This is a great book. Best of the season. Happy Christmas. All the best for the new year.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me. Take care.
You're very welcome. The book is called 100 Days That Changed Canada. It's published by HarperCollins. The website, it's a great website, incidentally. I went to it over the weekend a couple times, canadashistory.ca. Mark Reed. He's the editor-in-chief of Canada's History magazine. On the line from Winnipeg and Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.